Last week in 2 Samuel chapter 2, we saw David finally taking his rightful place on the in Israel, not over all Israel yet, only over the tribe of Judah. We began to look at some ways in which I believe that his kingdom foreshadows the kingdom of his descendant, Jesus Christ. So we come today to chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. It says, "There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker." So I shared with you last week that I think that this civil war that's going on in Israel is kind of a picture of the conflict that happens inevitably when the reign of Christ collides with what we might call the old dynasty. That is the carnal mind, which has ruled the life of every one of us until we chose to surrender ourselves to Christ as Lord. And we can see this scenario happening in the world, but most clearly perhaps we can see it happening within our own hearts. This is what Paul wrote in Galatians chapter 5, verses 16 to 17. "But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things you want to do." What Paul is picturing here is kind of an internal civil war. Because when we come to Christ and when we submit ourselves to his lordship, when we go underneath the waters of baptism and we are professing, "I want that old life to be reckoned as dead." That is kind of the language that Paul uses. You consider that old life to be dead. But that does not mean that it disappears. That does not mean that it no longer has any influence. It doesn't mean that it is not still hanging around and looking for opportunities to run things once again. But the thing about the carnal life is that it is connected to the physical body. As long as we are in these bodies, we are going to have this carnal nature still present until we reach the stage that Paul calls glorification, which is when this body is transformed to be like Christ, and we no longer have that carnal nature as a part of our lives at all. Because the carnal nature is connected to the physical body, it is actually, as is said of the kingdom of Saul here, the house of Saul, it is actually continuously growing weaker and weaker. The longer that we live, that's what happens to our physical bodies, is that they grow weaker. Paul talks about this when he speaks of the outward man perishing. But he says the inward man is being renewed day by day, because this new life that we have received in Christ is a supernatural life, drawing its energy, its force, its strength from the eternal God. And so it is possible for, if we are growing in Christ, for that to become, as the house of David did in this conflict, continuously stronger and stronger. If you see things this way, it's easier to understand why the Bible describes physical weakness as a potential enhancement of spiritual strength. Nobody likes to experience weakness or limitations in their life. I don't know of anyone that looks forward to, in a literal sense, to sickness or suffering or loss or limitation of any kind. But those things are going to come to us anyway. That is the reality of living in a broken world. We are going to experience these things. So we might as well view them through the lens of eternity. We might as well see them the way that God wants us to see them, the way that Paul learned to see them. You think about Paul, one of the most spiritual men who ever lived, an apostle who wrote almost half the New Testament. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, he describes the weakness and the trial that he experienced and how he really just wanted it to go away. He says this, beginning in verse 7 of 2 Corinthians 12, "So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations. A thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. I have never personally experienced a thorn. However, I have experienced something on a very minor scale. I don't know how many of you are like me in this, but you get just a tiny little piece of gravel in your shoe. And I like to go on long walks. And as I'm walking, I cannot think about anything else except that piece of gravel that's in my shoe. It's a very tiny thing, but it drives me insane. And it's like, I'm just going to have to stop and get this out because it's driving me crazy. And I think what Paul is dealing with here was probably something quite a bit worse than that. But that's how our minds are. They tend to focus on that one thing that is limiting us, that's making us weak, and we just see it as an obstruction. It's just like, I want this to go away. And here's the thing. Paul was the same way. He goes on to say, three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. What is happening within the Apostle Paul as God leaves this weakness, this thorn in his flesh, in his life? You could point to all the bad things about it and say, well, why does he need that distraction? He's already serving God. He's already doing all these wonderful things. Why doesn't God just take this away? Is exactly what Paul thought. But what is happening? Within him, David is growing stronger, and the house of Saul is growing weaker. His carnal nature that he still had, even though he was tremendously spiritual and knew the Lord better than probably any of us, I'm certainly speaking for myself, don't think ever will. Nevertheless, there was that carnal nature still there, and God allowed this weakness to hold it back from a temptation that was very much there. He said, to keep me from becoming conceited. That is something of the carnal nature. When people are listening to you, when they're hailing you in some way or whatever. I mean, Paul had a... I'm actually not sure how many people Paul had really praising him, but certainly he had this understanding himself that he had been given all these great revelations, and the carnal nature is ready immediately to try to get up on the throne and say, yeah, we're awesome, the greatest of the apostles. And God says, no, I'm going to leave something in your life that will make that grow weaker so that my power can be stronger. And Paul took hold of that so aggressively and so enthusiastically that he goes on to say, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Who boasts about weakness? Nobody. Nobody. But it wasn't for no reason. He didn't say, I'll boast about my weaknesses because I really enjoy being weak. He said, no, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Paul understood that this was the secret. And that as that carnal nature, that old dynasty became weaker and weaker, Christ in him, and the power of Christ would become stronger and stronger. We see it as a limitation or an obstacle. God sees it quite differently. That as that carnal life becomes weaker through the trials that we experience and through those limitations, his power in us becomes stronger. Verse 2 of Samuel 3. Sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel, and his second Chileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel, and the third Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, and the fourth Adonijah, the son of Haggith, and the fifth Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. Now, if you look in the Law of Moses, for the instructions that God gave regarding the potential for Israel to have a king. God did not command them to have a monarchy, But he foresaw, of course, that they were going to do this, and therefore he made some provision. He set certain rules, and there weren't very many of them. There were like less than five things that God said about what the king, future king of Israel ought to do and not do. And one of those things was, from Deuteronomy 17:17, he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. David apparently missed the memo. David was such a wise and godly man in so many areas of his life. But in this particular area, and we're going to see another example of this coming up here momentarily, he really seems to have had a big blind spot in the area of women. And instead of taking one wife and being faithful to her, as was God's original design from the Garden of Eden, David followed the example of the kings of the ancient world. This is what they did because they could, because they had the power to do it, because they could just say, okay, I'm taking this one and that one and the other one. And pretty much there was very little limit on that. So that's what he did. And in taking these wives, you can already see, if you know how the rest of the story goes, how David is sowing the seeds of his own grief, of division and even violence within his family. Of the six sons who are named here, three of them became major troublemakers. One assaulted his own sister. Another murdered that son who committed the assault and then led a rebellion against his father. And a third attempted to seize the kingdom when David was old and had already said who his successor was going to be, and it wasn't him, but he decided he was going to be king anyway. Three out of these six sons that were born of six different women caused major problems for David in his kingdom and in his life. Why? Because he took his cues from the world around him and from his peers rather than from what God had expressed in his word was his will. Galatians 6, verse 8 says, the one who sows to his flesh will from the flesh reap corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. And remember that it also says in another place, do not be deceived, God is not mocked. Whatever someone sows, that he also will reap. And it might have seemed great to David that now he was king, and now he could have all the wives that he wanted, and he could settle down and enjoy those relationships and have all of these children, and he could have justified it in his mind saying, this is what all the kings do, not being able to see into the future and realize how much grief was going to come his way because of these choices that he was making. In Romans 12 and verse 2, Paul says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Again, this comes back to this struggle that we have because that carnal nature remains within us. And a transformation needs to happen of our minds, causing us to think like God thinks and to see things like he sees them. And by actually living it out, Paul says, by testing, by exercising discernment, we find out what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Because he doesn't spell it out in every case. You notice he did not say to the kings of Israel, to the future kings of Israel, you're limited to one, or even you're limited to two wives, or four, or ten. He just said, don't multiply. He was giving them direction, so if they would seek him, they could figure out, okay, what is the will of God? But in this particular area of his life, it would seem that David did not really seek God. And that is why he got worse results in this area of his life than just about any other. It was within his own family that so much of the trouble started, because he failed to seek God in that area with all of his heart. Moving on to verse 6. While there was war between the house of David and the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, why have you gone in to my father's concubine? Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David, and yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. So when you start to analyze this conversation, you find there are a couple of rather head-scratching aspects to it on both sides. So first of all, Ishbosheth starts out by accusing his top general, his biggest supporter, the guy who is kind of the reason that his kingdom even exists, of having improperly had relations with this concubine of his father's. And then, of course, Abner blows up, and it says at the end, Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. So this leaves us with a question. If he feared him, why did he bring this up in the first place? Why did he start something that he couldn't finish? Again, what I see in the kingdom of Ishbosheth is kind of this picture of people who are calling themselves followers of God, but they're refusing the lordship of Christ, because again, it was David whom God had chosen to be the ruler. And from everything else we know about Ishbosheth, I mean, he was not an idolater. He wasn't someone who rejected the God of Israel, but he did reject God's choice to be the king. He was trying to do it himself. When people are in this condition, what develops is a kind of divide in their mind, and they end up embracing very contradictory ideas. And they may, in fact, want to confront some evil within themselves or in the world. But they find that they have no power against it. So they start things they cannot finish. They try to confront evil. Now, I don't know for certain, the Bible doesn't say if this was true or it wasn't, but Ishbosheth apparently thought it was true that Abner had done this, and so he set out to try to right this wrong, but he had no power against it. Because why? God was not backing him up. This we saw this last week with Asahel going after Abner. He was not backing him up. What do you need in order to go against evil? What's step one? James tells us in James 4, verse 7, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. If you want power against evil, you have to start by submitting yourself to God and to his authority. You have to be under the lordship of Christ and living in obedience to him. Outside of that, you try to confront evil, you will find yourself starting something you cannot finish. Now, it is interesting also to note that within Abner's response to Ishbosheth, there is also a contradiction. He says he is going to do for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel, over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba. Now, here's the question. If Abner really believed that God had sworn to David to make him king over all Israel, then why did he set up Ishbosheth as king in the first place? There's something wrong here. He's been fighting this whole time to maintain this split kingdom, and now he's saying, well, God swore to give the kingdom to David anyway, so I'm just going to go and do that. In Luke 6, in verse 46, Jesus asks a very sensible, very simple question. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I tell you? If Abner believed that David was the rightful king, that God had sworn to him to give him the kingdom of Israel, then why didn't he just align himself with that from the beginning? Why did he go off and try to prop up another king? Why do we call Jesus Lord, Lord, and do not do what he tells us? Because we want him to be Lord when his plans align with ours. When he is telling us to do things that we already want to do or don't particularly mind doing. Now, when his commandments take us a different way, when they cut across our will, when they require of us things that we do not want to give, then we embrace this contradiction. And we find a way to rationalize doing what we want. So when did Abner get this revelation that David was the rightful king? When he felt insulted and angry and wanted to get back at Ishbosheth. So suddenly he wants to do what he knows to be God's will, because now it aligns with his own purposes. And unfortunately, we often see this kind of hypocritical behavior in those who have some kind of legitimate authority from God, but they wield it like a club to get their own will done, to deflect criticism and accountability, to beat down anybody that might challenge them. And that's not what it's for. It's the opposite of what it's for, and God hates to be misrepresented in this way. People can be saying the right thing, as Abner is saying it here. Well, God swore to David to give him the whole kingdom, so I'm just going to go do that. And even doing the right thing, but not doing it from the right heart. Because if his heart had been right, he would have done it from the beginning. He wouldn't have waited until he had now an ulterior motive, the motive of revenge and of anger towards Ishbosheth. So now he's going to go do God's will, but not from a right heart. 12, and Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you." And he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face until you first bring my call Saul's daughter when you come to see my face." And David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife, my call, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel the son of Laish, but her husband went with her weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go, return," and he returned. So as I said a moment ago, I believe that when it came to women, David's decisions ranged from questionable to outright sinful and destructive. This one I would put in the category of questionable. The law of Moses did not allow a woman who had been divorced, gone and married someone else, to then come back to her first husband, even if she was divorced. That was prohibited. Now, it could be that this divorce of David from Michal was never legitimate to begin with, and it could be that David was writing that wrong. I have to tread lightly here because there's no commentary given on this in the scripture. The fruit of it does not seem to have been particularly good. Michal was not a good wife to David. We find later that she seems to have been rather bitter against him, and you can kind of see why. It was not, as far as we know, her choice to be married to someone else. That was arranged by her father, Saul. But she had become a mother to this man's children. We find out later there's a mention of her having raised his kids, and he obviously was quite attached to her. And so David decides, for whatever reasons, that he's going to break up that home and bring her back to himself, when he already has six other women. This just does not seem to me like a really good idea. It is very tempting, again, when we feel powerful, to use the power to get what we want. And I think that this had been probably eating at David for a long time. And it was wrong what Saul did. It was wrong in taking his wife away from him and forcing him to be on the run and not be able to be with her for all of those years. But does this right the wrong? That's the question. I don't think it necessarily does. I think it's just a way of David satisfying himself that, well, I set that straight. Now I'm the king. I can command it. So bring her to me, whether it's good for her or good for the family that she had to leave, or even for him. I mean, that's kind of an open question. The more power you have, and this is the flip side of how weakness causes us to have the power of Christ resting upon us, but power in a fleshly sense, in terms of position or health or strength or intelligence or money or whatever it is, it can actually cause us to stray away from dependence on God. And that is why the more of it you have, the more intentional you have to seek God, to make sure that you use the power in the right way and that you do not misrepresent the Lord. Because all authority is given to be used for the good of those under that authority. That's the way that God works. And anyone misuses, misrepresents God, We saw last week how important it is for us to be led by the cross, by the example of Jesus Christ, who would never use the power that he had for his own benefit, but only for the benefit of others. He had the power to have compelled the obedience and the worship of every person on earth. But instead, he humbled himself. He became obedient, subjecting himself to earthly parents, to authorities, even to unjust ones, even to blasphemers, even to, Paul says, death on a cross. He came to offer salvation, to offer for men to humble themselves under his lordship and become a part of his kingdom, and left each soul free to accept or reject that offer. He is not a tyrant using his authority in ways that please him, but using the authority he received from the Father to benefit all of humanity. Continuing on in verse 17, Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.' Abner also spoke to Benjamin, and then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, 'I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires.' So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace." Just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, "Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace." Then Joab went to the king and said, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he has gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you're doing." So here we have two very powerful and ambitious men, Joab and Abner. Each, I think, pretending to some extent to be concerned with David's welfare and the welfare of his kingdom. But in reality, each of these men is primarily motivated by something he wants for himself. We saw the reason that Abner ditched Ishbosheth and decided to switch loyalties to David was because he felt insulted, and he is looking for revenge on the man that he had set up as king. Probably he's also looking for a top spot in David's court, would be my guess. Joab wants his own revenge. He wants revenge on Abner for the death of his brother, even though he must have known, because it is recorded, that Abner did not want to kill Asahel, that Asahel basically forced him to do it. Psalm 118, verse 9 says this: "It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes." Now, if you've heard that that's the middle verse in the Bible, I'm sorry to burst your bubble. It's actually not. I don't know where that myth got started. However, it is a very important principle, because we are very much attracted to anything that looks like power. And when we can persuade ourselves that that person who seems to have power is also a good person, or they say some good things, it's very easy to want to jump on the bandwagon and say, "Oh yeah, we need to go along with this person and support them and kind of just turn a blind eye to the bad things that they're doing because they do these good things that we agree with." And to some extent, I don't think that's necessarily a problem as far as supporting someone in the good that they're trying to do. We must stop short of putting our confidence or our hope in any fallible human being. Because most often, the wielders of power in this world have mixed motives at best. And it is a mistake for the people of God and those whose citizenship is in heaven to jump on any earthly bandwagon and say, "Yeah, we're going to be part of this movement and support this person." Because very quickly, we may find ourselves being associated with things that are very ungodly. It is not necessarily so that because one person is wicked, the person opposing them is necessarily righteous. They may both be wicked, and God may be using one to judge the other, but they may both in the end be headed for judgment. There is one to whom our loyalty, our unquestioned devotion belongs, and that is Jesus Christ. Verse 26, Joab came out from David's presence. He sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. What Abner did in killing Asahel in the first place was, I think, wrong in the larger context of his refusal to submit to David as king. But in the moment, it was basically self-defense. He wasn't given a choice. What Joab did in retaliation was much, much worse. This was cold-blooded murder. You could look at it that Joab was almost as responsible for his own brother's death as Abner, because he had agreed to the fight between the, remember, the 12 and 12 that all killed each other. He had agreed to that, and that's what started the battle. And then when it was clear that Abner and the Benjamites were beaten, he and his men kept chasing them. He didn't call them off. And so his brother ends up getting killed. Now, he might have felt guilty about that, but he didn't deal with that. Instead, he allowed his anger towards Abner, the one who had actually killed Asahel, to harden into a desire for revenge. And this blinded him to the point that he could justify in his own mind committing a treacherous act of murder. Ephesians 4, 26 to 27 says, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil." Never underestimate what the devil can do if you do give him an opportunity. If you do let the sun go down on your anger, if you don't deal with things, you may not end up like Joab did, actually literally killing someone. But this is how so many marriages are destroyed, so many relationships, I would say probably many churches, end up getting destroyed because the enemy is given that access, because he is given that opportunity when someone does not deal with their anger or their offense or even their guilt. The enemy gets in the door, and he ultimately undermines the whole thing. I can't imagine that this is something that Joab would have seen himself doing as a fighting man, as a man I would assume who had some honor, that this would be how he would deal with the situation, was by making Abner think that he was going to have a conversation with him and then killing him. God says that vengeance belongs to him. We are not to take vengeance. So that, if that thought ever comes that, oh, I need to even the score here, that's something that we can just immediately cut off and say, no, that's not your job. Not your job to even the score. God keeps the score. He's the only one who actually even knows what the score is. So when we try to even it, what happens? We just end up escalating. And one evil is exchanged for another evil, and we end up destroying one another. But God is the one who will bring all things into balance and justice at the end of all, and we have to leave that to him. Verse 31. No. I think I skipped some. Sorry. When David heard of it, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner." And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, "Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." And all the people wept over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." I think what we can see here is an early indication of another major weakness that is going to plague David throughout his reign, which is his reluctance, or indeed his outright refusal, to deal with evil when it is found in people that are close to him. Now, David knew that this was something he needed to do. He wrote about it in Psalm 105, verses 5 and then 7 through 9. "Whoever slanders his neighbor secretly," he said, "I will destroy. Whoever has a haughty look and an arrogant heart, I will not endure. No one who practices deceit shall dwell in my house. No one who utters lies shall continue before my eyes. Morning by morning, I will destroy all the wicked in the land, cutting off all the evildoers from the city of the Lord." So, I think we have probably all said things, in my case even preached things, that we do not live up to. In fact, I probably preached some things this morning that I will fail to live up to in the next 24 hours, if not the next 24 minutes. So I am not being hard on a very godly man who is closer to God, again, than I probably ever will be. But I do believe that these things are written for our learning. And we can see, because the Bible shows us, where are the weaknesses and the contradictions in the lives of those whom God used to do things. And here we see a contradiction, because David said, "I will cut off the evildoers." That was his responsibility as king. He was supposed to do that. But here, one of his most trusted, loyal, effective soldiers is absolutely indisputably guilty of cold-blooded murder. And while he distanced himself from that and made it clear he had nothing to do with it, he didn't do anything about it. At the end of the day, he said, "Well, God will punish the evildoers." Now, in the case of Saul, he was right to leave it to God, because it wasn't his job. God had not appointed him as Saul's authority, but he was the authority over Joab. He was the king. It was his job to do something about it, and he chose to do nothing. He called it gentleness. He said, "I was gentle, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I am." Unfortunately, this is the opposite extreme from the misuse of what we want to the failure to use it at all when it is called for. Because there is a time to speak up, there is a time to act, there is a time to confront evil. And this, I believe, is also related, we will see, to David's failures as a father. The Bible actually explicitly says regarding one of his sons who went really bad that his father had never displeased him, had never said to him, "Why have you done that?" Well, if you've raised a son to the age of 18 and never displeased them, you did not do your job. I'm sorry. I think that David had been through so much in his life that this was... He just didn't want to deal with the things in the people that were close to him. He didn't want to commit it, if it was a close friend or someone in his family. He just called it gentleness. But in reality, I think it was kind of being AWOL. It was not fulfilling the obligation that he had. Because evil does need to be confronted. The first place you have to confront evil is in your own heart. In fact, that is the only place in which we have complete control, because we are given control by the Holy Spirit. Paul says, "Sin shall not have dominion over you, because you are not under the law." But so we have dominion within the realm of our own hearts. And when the reign of Christ truly takes hold, it ought to flip our world upside down, or rather, right side up. When self is on the throne, I am going to think of in terms of what I need from others, how they're going to support me, how they're going to help me, and what their obligations are to me, and how I can use the power that I have to get done what I want done. But when Christ sits on the throne, it's a very different story. Because he causes us to think in terms of what others need from us, what our obligations are to them. Philippians 2, verses 3 to 4 says, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others." Galatians 5:13 says, "For you were called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." And in Mark 10:45, this is what Jesus said of himself, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." This is how our King uses his power. He rules his kingdom by love. Love wills the good of another. Love looks at the situation and says, what does that person in front of me need? What will be for their good? What will build them up? Sometimes it may be a hard word. It may be something that you have to do, especially if you're a parent. You're going to run into this, that there will be times that you are going to have to be the bad guy and your kids are not going to like you very much. Sometimes, and if you neglect that, the Bible says basically it's as though you hate them, as though you are a party to their destruction. That is just as bad as the opposite extreme, which is to misuse that authority to get your own will done. Whether that situation in front of you calls for patience, calls for restraint, even silence, or whether it calls for action with courage, the right response starts in a heart of self-sacrificial love. It's all about who's occupying the throne at that moment. Because if it is self, there will be no real love, because self does not want to be sacrificed. Self wants to be preserved, comforted, respected, and accommodated. And so if self is running the show, you will not walk in love. You will sacrifice others for your sake rather than sacrificing yourself for their sake. But when Christ occupies the throne, when he is ruling uncontested, his love will rule our every thought, word, and deed. Whether we speak or remain silent, whether we move or remain still, whether we give or withhold, it will be for the good of those around us and for the glory of our King.